So after Palestine and Bosnia, what's next? What could be your next project, or should I say your next trip?
Well, the next project is I'm trying to finish some things about Bosnia. There's a couple of comics I want to finish. I might want to go back to the Middle East to do another project, but I also have in mind to do some humorous work again. And one of the main things I have in mind is to work on something about the Rolling Stones.
When talking about your work, people often use the terms comics journalism or new journalism. What do you mean by new journalism?
I don't know how to categorize myself. I don't really think of myself as a new journalist. I say I do comics journalism because that's what I do. And it's a very short way of describing what I do to people, you know. It's an easier term. What I do is comics, is journalism in the format of comics. And it might sound unusual, but it's a very organic outgrowth of my two loves and my two interests. I studied journalism. I have a degree in journalism, but I was doing comics from when I was a kid. And my career in journalism never really went anywhere. I started a career in comics, and putting the two things together seemed very natural to me. I didn't have a big theory behind it. Mm-hmm. But basically what it is I'm trying to present information about the world or places I'm interested in the format of comics. And I behave much like a journalist when I'm in the field, and then I translate that into a comics format.
Why this exhibition now, and why in Italy?
Why now? Because they asked me now. I mean, I had nothing to do with it. I think it's almost a coincidence that my book came out along with the exhibition. I don't think the two are really related. My book Palestine came out in a new edition in Italian. And why Ravenna?
Because Italy.
Why Italy? Because Italy asked me, and because I like Italy. I get invited to many places, and I have to pick and choose, but I'm always very happy to come to Italy, because the wine is so good.
Well, Giovanni Lindo Ferretti, an Italian singer, in a song about Sarajevo, wrote, "We are fucked in a weaponless war. We are fucked in a killing around peace. We are fucked by our priests, Pope and Mullah, by UN, NATO, civility. This is a trap of cowardice. Do you think these words fit the situation of Bosnia during war?"
I think there's a lot of people who are fucked over, and yeah, there are a lot of groups who fuck you over in a situation like that. But I think there are very specific things that happened in Bosnia. And personally, I don't like to generalize things too much, because then you begin to become maybe misanthropic. You begin to think, oh, well, that's how people are. People kill each other, and one side did it, the other side does it. It's the same thing. But it's not. There are reasons things happen, and usually one side, I find that maybe both sides commit atrocities, but in one side, it's a question of degree, but one side committed more atrocities, and one side it was sanctioned by their leaders and their government. The other side, it's more accidental or incidents that happen locally. So I think, in some ways I understand these lyrics, I understand the frustration behind them, but I think you've got to look at a situation for the specifics of a situation. You can't say all situations are alike and we're always just fucked and that's all there is to it.
What do you think the international community should or could have done?
I think that's one of the things that got me interested in what was going on in Bosnia, because it was clear to me that there was ethnic cleansing on a grand scale, or a great scale, and some real ethnic chauvinism and ethnic nationalism and quasi-fascism going on. And for a long time, the world had referred back to what happened in World War II, especially in regard to the Jews, and said, this will never happen again, never again. And it was happening again. And the international community responded, I think, very poorly. I think the Europeans tried to take on the situation, and they didn't know what to do. I think the Europeans behaved miserably in Bosnia, really badly. The British, the French, they all had their own agendas there. and they behaved atrociously. When America finally took the ball, the same thing. I mean, Clinton was wanted to have the moral high ground. Typically, he liked to preach about what should be done and shouldn't be done, but he wasn't willing to commit to doing something. And really, committing to doing something means intervening.
Yeah.
And intervening means getting your hands dirty and maybe getting your hands bloody. And that's eventually, the world was embarrassed into acting in this way. They were embarrassed into doing it, mainly because the massacres were so outrageous, especially in Srebrenica, a UN protected zone, a so-called safe area that was not safe, that they had to act. They could no longer stand aside. When they acted, the war ended. It didn't necessarily solve all the problems of the war. It hasn't. But the war ended. And that shows that sometimes international action is appropriate. If it had happened 3 years before, maybe 200,000 people would be alive today.
In No Man's Land by Dan Stanovich, the Golden Globe Award winner movie, there was a very critical attitude toward the international community too. That film also compared Bosnia to a man lying on an armed mine for whom nobody could do anything. Do you share this metaphor? Or is there something that can be done once the underlying violence has been armed?
Has already started?
Has been primed in.
Well, once the violence starts, I mean, all bets are off, as they say in English. In other words, it could go in any kind of direction. But that doesn't mean, I think, that you can turn away or you shouldn't try to stop what can be saved. I mean, whatever can be saved, you have to save. Even if nine people are dead, if one is still alive, you have to try to save that one person. I think it's important. Like I said, I don't like these generalizations about situations, like it's all hopeless, or once it starts, forget it. But there is a certain truth to it also. I mean, at a certain point, things are going to just get worse until someone stops and does something about it. I haven't seen the film, by the way. I've heard many good things about it.
Let's talk about Palestine. It sounds like your work is still very actual, after all. The peace process seems at a kind of stand.
I don't know if there was any peace process. I mean, this is a term invented by people who it's to their advantage to use this expression. The peace process existed for the Israelis, and it existed for the benefit of American politicians, particularly Bill Clinton. It never existed for the Palestinian people, because since Oslo, since 1993, the settlements, the number of Israeli settlers has almost doubled in the West Bank and Gaza. More land has been taken. More Arab crops have been destroyed. And now there's a new intifada, and you can see that Israel uses a level of violence now that was unheard of even a few months ago. It's become the accepted situation. It's become the norm to use fighter bombers and Apache helicopters and missiles and tanks to do this sort of work. There have been no benefits for the Palestinians with this peace process. I mean, the unemployment is even greater. There's now, when I was there 10 years ago, at least some Palestinians could work in Israel. Now it's impossible for them to go and work. I mean, the unemployment has gone up, and the government the Palestinians have for themselves, the Palestine Authority, is corrupt, doesn't really help its people, and behaves in a manner at times quite like the Israelis did, you know, when there was a full occupation.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously the Palestinians have not had any benefits from the so-called peace process.
Now a strange question. Sinéad O'Connor once compared the Irish people to an abused child that has to remember its trauma to really go past its shock. Don't you think that in a kind of way Israeli people is somehow remembering too much without being able to go past it? Like it was trapped in a loop and has to repeat what has learned from its past torturers, or is just cheap analysis to you?
I don't know if it's cheap analysis. I mean, I think it's true to say that the person most likely to abuse someone is someone who's been abused beforehand. And a lot of people say, how can the Israelis do that after what happened to the Jews in World War II? Wouldn't they know better? But that's perhaps precisely why they do what they do. I mean, they obviously care a lot about their own survival. They've had a horrible history themselves, pogroms all over Europe, and the Holocaust, of course. And unfortunately, what they've done is turned this on its head, and they've abused Palestinians who've had nothing to do with what happened in Europe in the 1900s and in the 20th century. So, and you see the Palestine Authority also learning from its oppressors. They use a lot of the same tactics the Israelis have used. So it's very typical, I think, for someone who's abused to abuse in turn.
You witnessed a process at the Tribunal of The Hague. What do you think about it? Would it be effective if countries like America would really join it, or is there another way to accomplish the Western countries' will?
Well, America has joined the tribunal at the Hague. I think what America is refusing to do is establish a permanent international criminal court. And of course it would be a good thing, but America realizes that it might be up for certain charges, and they're afraid of it. They don't want Americans to be put on trial, and that's the problem for America. And America would be serving its greater purpose by joining this international effort. It would be a good thing for the world if these courts could continue. The criminal tribunal at the Hague has many problems. It's very slow. You know, like I say, it has many problems, but it's still important. You know, has Milosevic there. Milosevic is a big fish. He's not some small person. It's important that someone like him is put on trial. And so I definitely support these international efforts. I wish America would support them more.
Talking about your art, you're a complete author. You write and draw your own comics. So a few questions about your style. Do you usually write a proper script before you start drawing, or do you just start from the single page layout?
No, I write a full script because I feel to organize the material well, you need to have a very comprehensive understanding of what you're trying to do. I know other cartoonists work more organically, but they're doing fiction. I'm trying to tell a story that I already know the beginning, the middle, and the end of, and I have to get from point A to point B. And it's better if I map it out beforehand.
Your art is very effective for the kind of comics journalism you write. How did you develop it? That is it the things you write about that need a certain style, or is it the other way around?
Well, I used to draw in a very cartoony fashion, but that changed. I became more realistic because I felt it makes the work more realistic. You know, if I'm... My first few comics that I did about the Palestinians were, you know, typical cartoon style, but I thought it would be more appropriate to approach things more literally, more realistically. And I think it adds a certain truth when you do that. You know, it makes things real. It's very important for me to show as much detail as possible, to really make a place alive. I don't like to work with abstractions.
Yeah, and you manage.
Yeah, thank you.
What do you think has influenced your art style?
My art style?
Yeah.
Well, there's a couple of cartoonists. The first one would be a guy named Will Elder, mm-hmm. who used to work for the old Mad Comic before it was a magazine, back in the 50s, because he had a very dense and detailed art style. The next one is probably Robert Crumb, for obvious reasons. I mean, I do a lot of hatch work. And what I liked about his work the most was he always drew in a very organic way. Every object looked like he put some care into it. Every object looked like it was alive somehow. And I always take my cue from him. I always try the same thing. I try to care about everything I draw. There's a few fine artists I'm interested in. One is Peter Bruegel the Elder. He was a Flemish painter in the 1500s because he was able to really draw people in real life. I'm very affected by his work. And then some German expressionists, or German painters anyway, between World War I and World War II, like Otto Dix, Max Ernst, people who were trying to show what life was really like. I mean, trying to get to the sort of the grotesque truth, and that interested me also.
What do you wish the catalyst of the seminar would be, would learn from you?
I hope they learn how to fill up 7 or 8 hours with talking, because I'm not sure exactly what I'm going to say to them.
What do you think of multimedia? You once played in a band, didn't you?
No, I never played in a band. I don't know how to play an instrument. I toured with a rock band. I was selling T-shirts.
last question. I read on the seminar website you won the Pulitzer Prize. What was it like?
I never won the Pulitzer Prize. That's a lie. Or that's a big mistake by someone. I don't know where they got that from. But if all the Italians want to believe it, that's okay with me too. But I never won the Pulitzer Prize.
Thank you.